bruises for anything that might seem amiss. She winced as I turned her head from side to side.
She's okay, Mayor said.
What were... I saw her when she got off the bus. I was just talking to her for a little while.
Are you okay? I asked Maribel.
She nodded and stared at me with her wide owl eyes. I felt the punch of relief, swift and firm to my gut. She was okay. Maybe it should have bothered me more. The thought of Maribel out here alone with Mayor. But as boys went, Mayor struck me as the harmless sort. Besides, I was so overcome with gratitude in that moment that there wasn't room for much else. She was okay. I didn't even have the heart to ask whether she was sure, because I didn't want to give her the chance to take it back. She had said she was okay. And that was all I wanted.
Mayor. The Riveras started going to the same mass as us, and afterwards my mom usually invited them over for lunch at our house. They protested the first time. No, no, it's too much. We don't want to impose. But my mom, who was always eager to make new friends in this country, wore them down eventually, and the three of them got off the bus with us and walked straight to our apartment, laying their coats over the back of the couch, getting comfortable on the chairs my mom pulled in from the kitchen and arranged around the living room. My mom made sure everyone had drinks, and then she got busy, week after week, making her special party food. Ham sandwiches on white bread with the crusts trimmed off. She cut them into triangles and speared them with plastic toothpicks, then carried them out on a ceramic platter that she passed around to everyone along with square white napkins that we used to catch the crumbs. My dad, on the other hand, didn't let the presence of the Riveras interfere with his usual routine. He turned on the television, cracked open a can of beer, and put his socked feet up on the coffee table. He watched soccer if it was on, which inevitably led to him talking about Enrique and bragging about the latest goal my brother had scored against Georgetown or the assist he'd had in the big game against Virginia, which was Maryland's main rival, and how almost every week Enrique's name was in the paper under the sports stats that were listed for every high school and college within a 100-mile radius of us. Mayor plays soccer too, he said, but I haven't seen his name in the paper yet. He didn't say it to be mean. It was the truth, even though not for the reason he thought, and he looked at me with pity. But he's getting better, aren't you? He asked. And I struggled to nod through the rush of guilt I felt about lying to him and the humiliation I felt about sucking so bad. When soccer wasn't on, my dad turned to football. One week, during an Eagles game, when Señor Rivera cheered Donovan McNabb on, my dad wrote him, saying, Arturo, it's no use. I've been watching these games since I got to this country, and yes, the Eagles are a bird, but let me tell you, they no can fly. He said the last part in English, to be funny. And even though I'm not sure Señor Rivera understood him, he was nice enough to laugh. In the beginning, I ate the crustless sandwiches and opened the can of Coke, then excused myself to my bedroom to do homework or to listen to my iPod. My mom would track me down sometimes and give a disapproving look and try to convince me that it would be nice if I came out and talked to Maribel, because she and I were basically the same age, and because she was new here, so she would probably appreciate me talking to her. Don't you think that would be nice? My mom asked. But I didn't think so. I mean, maybe it would have been nice for Maribel, but otherwise, what was the point? Looking at her, sure. I could have looked at her all day. But actually having conversations with her? That was a different story. Then one week, I was walking home from my bus stop in the rain, when from behind, someone said, Where are you going? I turned around and saw Garrett Miller grinning at me, his skateboard under his arm. Home? I said. Back to Mexico? I'm not from Mexico. My dad says all you people are from Mexico. When I didn't respond, Garrett said, "What are you looking at?" Garrett didn't have a single friend that I knew of. His older brother had gone to Iraq with the Air Force and had come back in a body bag. The rumor at school was that Garrett's mom had a breakdown after that. She just couldn't handle it, so she'd split and hadn't been back since. Supposedly, Garrett's dad started drinking so much that he lost his job. They must have been living off benefits from the military or something. Or maybe they were on welfare by now. I didn't know. I started walking away. I could hear Garrett trailing me, the shuffle of his sneakers on the pavement, the drag of his jeans. What was I supposed to do? Was he going to follow me all the way up to my door? What did he want? And then I heard another sound, the low rumble of an engine. I looked back and saw a bus, Maribel's bus, turning off the road. It drove past Garrett and me and pulled up in front of the building. I watched as Maribel got off, walking down the steps like a deer carefully picking its way down the side of a mountain. At the sight of her, I forgot about Garrett for a second. She might have been one of the Evers kids, but she was still the prettiest girl I had ever seen in real life. After the bus bounced back onto the road, Maribel just stood in the middle of the parking lot in the drizzling rain. She didn't move.
"Hey,"
Garrett called. Maribel turned.
"You remember me? I saw you a few weeks ago at the gas station."
Maribel stared at him.
"What's your name?" Garrett asked.
When she didn't answer, he said,
"What's the matter? You don't speak English? No inglés?"
She shook her head. I watched as Garrett took a step back and surveyed Maribel from head to toe, nodding in appreciation. She didn't squirm, didn't shift, just stood there letting herself be ogled.
"Take off your sunglasses so I can see your eyes," Garrett said.
But instead of waiting for her to do it, he pulled her sunglasses off her face himself. When Maribel reached for them, Garrett held them up in the air where she couldn't get them. Reflexively, Maribel put her hand over her eyes.
"What?" Garrett said. "Something wrong with your eyes?"
He pried her hand away and held on to it. I cringed. He snaked his head closer to study her face and then pulled back, looking confused.
"Something wrong with you?"
he said, dropping her hand like he'd just been burned. Then he whistled as if he'd put it together.
"That's why you were on that bus, isn't it? You're some kind of retard. How do you say retard in Spanish? Hey!"
Garrett said, waving his arm in front of her blank face.
"I'm talking to you. Can't you hear?"
I took a step, then stopped. What did I think I was going to do? Garrett twirled her sunglasses around.
"You need these back?"
When Maribel reached for them, Garrett tossed the sunglasses up in a high arc over her head and let them land on the wet pavement. Maribel bent down to get them, and Garrett crowded up behind her, settling his hands on her hips, drawing her against him.
"Hey!"
I yelled. Garrett whipped his head around like he'd forgotten that I was there.
"Leave her alone,"
I said.
"Fuck you! She hasn't done anything to you."
Garrett narrowed his eyes to slits and sauntered toward me, nudging his skateboard along with the toe of his shoe. My heart was thudding so hard, it felt like it was taking up my whole chest. But at least I'd gotten him away from Maribel. Over his shoulder, I saw her stand and put her sunglasses back on, pushing them up the bridge of her nose with her finger.
"What are you, her fucking fairy godmother?"
Garrett said. He was right in front of me now, a head taller and at least 30 pounds heavier. I should have just stayed out of it, I thought. Why didn't I just stay out of it? "No," I managed to say.
"You want to be a hero?"
I shook my head.
"Because I was just talking to her," Garrett said. "That's all."
But that wasn't all, and both of us knew it. "I saw you," I said. Garrett grabbed the collar of my shirt and twisted it into his fist, pulling me close.
Saw what, shitface?
I didn't dare look in his eyes.
Couldn't hear you,
Garrett said, squeezing my collar until it felt like a noose around my neck.
Nothing,
I managed to get out. It was probably only a matter of seconds, but it felt like a full minute passed, maybe more, before Garrett finally let me go, sending me stumbling back onto my ass.
That's what I thought, he said. Fucking none of your business.
He kicked a spray of pebbles in my direction, then turned around and looked at Maribel, who was still standing basically in the same place she'd been the whole time.
I'm not done with you, he called to her.
He picked up his skateboard and started walking out toward the road, through the gravel. I brushed myself off and walked over to Maribel.
Are you okay?
I asked.
She nodded.
Don't pay attention to him, I said. He's a jerk. And then we were just standing there. And the rain was still drizzling like static, and I didn't know what to do next.
Are you going home now?
I finally asked, after a traffic jam of silence.
I'm waiting for my mom.
I looked up and down the length of the building, but besides Maribel and me, no one was around.
Where is she?
I asked.
Who?
Your mom.
She meets me at the bus.
Do you think she's in your apartment?
Maribel shook her head. I'm meeting her here.
What was I supposed to do? I didn't really want to stand out in the rain with her for who knew how long. Maybe Micho or Benny would walk out and one of them would keep her company. After another minute, though, it was still just her and me, so I said, well, let's wait on the fire escape at least. It's covered, so we can get out of the rain. As soon as we sat on the metal fire escape landing, Maribel slid her backpack off and pulled out a green notebook. She snapped the cap off a pen and started writing, hunched over the paper.
What's that?
I asked.
My notebook.
You're doing homework now?
I'm writing.
About what?
She shrugged. The doctors told me to write.
Like, stories? She didn't answer. I just finished the new Percy Jackson book, The Titan's Curse. Have you heard of it? Again, nothing. I couldn't even tell if she was listening to me, but for some reason, now I wanted her to. I wanted her to pay attention to me. I write sometimes, I went on. Like, I might write, note to self, do not touch a habanero pepper, even if your best friend dares you to. Unexpectedly, she smiled.
Habaneros are hot,
she said. It was the kind of smile that could wreck a person. No kidding, I said. I learned the hard way. I couldn't see her eyes because of her sunglasses, but I had the feeling she was staring straight at me. Then I heard a voice calling her name, screaming it in panic. My mom, she said. She dropped her notebook in her bag, and the two of us grabbed our things and walked out to see Señora Rivera darting across the parking lot like a wild animal.
Mari,
she said, when she laid eyes on us. Her hair was falling out of its ponytail, and her face was flushed. She ran to Maribel and put her hands on Maribel's cheeks, turning her head from side to side, examining her. She's okay, I said. I saw her when she got off the bus. I was just talking to her for a little while. I figured there was no reason to tell her about Garrett. I had taken care of it, hadn't I? And she would only freak out if she knew. That's how parents were.
Maribel,
Señora Rivera said, looking for confirmation of my story.
You're okay?
Maribel nodded, and even though Señora Rivera looked skeptical, she took Maribel by the wrist, leading her up to their apartment while I stood there in the spitting rain and watched them go. After that, something between Maribel and me changed. I felt this weird protectiveness over her, so on Sundays after church, instead of hiding away in my room like I used to, I made it a point to sit next to her on our brown couch, attempting to have quiet conversations with her, and telling stupid jokes in an effort to make her smile again, like I had that one time. One Sunday, while our parents debated the meaning of Father Finnegan's homily that morning, the doorbell rang. When my mom got up to answer it, Kiskeya was standing at the door with a coffee cake in her hands. Ever since the Riveras had moved in, my mom hadn't shown as much interest in Kiskeya as she used to, preferring instead to spend her time with Senora Rivera. I didn't blame her. I never understood why my mom hung out with Kiskeya at all, except that my mom craved friends, any friends, as a way to keep her from feeling lonely here.
"Oh," Kiskeya said, peeking inside. "I didn't know you had company."
"Did you tell me you were coming over?" my mom asked.
"No, but... well, there was a time when I didn't have to make plans to see you."
"I didn't know if I'd forgotten."
"I see. Do you want to come in?"
Kiskeya peered into our living room. Senora Rivera waved.
"No," Kiskeya said.
"Maybe tomorrow morning?" my mom offered. "I'll be here if you want to stop by."
Kiskeya shrank a little and twisted her lips. "Maybe," she said.
My mom was still standing with one hand on the doorknob. When neither Kiskeya nor my mom said anything else, my dad yelled,
"Have a good day, Kiskeya!"
"Yes, well," she said, and walked away.
I watched her pass by our front window on her way back to her apartment. My mom closed the door and said to my dad,
"You're so bad."
My dad said,
"You're lucky I didn't ask her to leave the coffee cake."
The conversation turned to politics after that, which was all anybody had been talking about lately. The elections had happened a few weeks earlier, and everybody we knew had been pulling for Barack Obama. Since she'd become a citizen, my mom had voted in every election, local and federal. She never missed a single one. She would come home and say,
"Well, I did my duty. May the best man win."
This year, she'd been the first in line at her polling place. She'd worn her American flag sweater, and I'd seen her praying before she walked out the door that morning.
"A little extra insurance can't hurt," she'd explained, crossing herself. "En el nombre del Padre y del Hijo y del Espíritu Santo. Amén."
When she came home, she said,
"Well, I did my duty. May Obama win, because if it's McCain, I will shoot myself."
And then she glued herself to the television all day long to watch the returns. Even my dad, who, whenever politics came up, usually dismissed the entire topic with his patented line,
"All politicians are equally corrupt,"
showed an interest this year. A few times, I even caught him watching the news segments about Obama in the evenings after he got home from work. It seemed like everyone in our building was excited. I'd seen Jose Mercado totter outside one day and plant an Obama-Biden sign in the grass bordering the parking lot. And Fito, who usually had a thing against signs, he'd taken down Benny's Phillies banner at the start of last year's baseball season, let it stand. Micho made sure that all of us who were documented were registered to vote, talking about how important it was that Obama, a black man who looked like no other U.S. president and who had family that came from different places, could possibly lead our country. It meant that we, who also resembled no other U.S. president and who also had family from faraway places, could one day rise up and do the same thing.
"I don't think his ears are so big," my mom said.
"His ears?" Senora Rivera asked.
"He keeps saying they're big, but I think he's very handsome."
"That's why you voted for him?" my dad said. "Because you think he's handsome?"
"Yes, Rafael, that's why I vote for one politician over another, because he's handsome. Are you crazy?"
My dad glared at my mom for a second, then emphatically put his feet up on the coffee table, something that my mom hated.
"We'll see," my dad said.
"We'll see what?"
Senor Rivera asked.
"We'll see what he does for us. I like him, okay? But I don't know if he's going to be who he said he would be. Politicians will say anything to get elected. For some reason, with this guy,
I believed what he said. I believed he believed what he said. But we'll see. The first thing he needs to do is get the economy out of the sewer. No one comes to the diner anymore. No one has money to eat out.
And now there are pirates, my mom said. Pirates? Señora Rivera asked, alarmed.
From Africa, my mom said. Black pirates.
That's awesome, I said.
They're hijacking ships, my mom said.
I pictured guys with beards and eye patches and peg legs. I still thought it was pretty awesome.
Señor Rivera said, but here, it's safe, no?
It's not as safe as it used to be, my dad said.
But it's safe,
Señor Rivera pressed, like he wanted to be reassured.
Yes, my dad said. Compared to where any of us are from, it's safe.
I was less than a year old when my parents brought my brother and me to the United States. Enrique was 4. He used to tell me things about Panama that I couldn't possibly have remembered, like about the scorpions in our backyard and the cement utility sink where my mom used to give us baths. He reminisced about walking down the street with my mom to the Super 99, the dust blowing up everywhere, the heat pounding down, and about looking for crabs between the rocks along the bay.
It's in you, my dad assured me once. You were born in Panama. It's in your bones.
I spent a lot of time trying to find it in me, but usually I couldn't. I felt more American than anything, but even that was up for debate, according to the kids at school who taunted me over the years, asking me if I was related to Noriega, telling me to go back through the canal. The truth was that I didn't know which I was. I wasn't allowed to claim the thing I felt, and I didn't feel the thing I was supposed to claim. The first time I heard my parents tell the story about leaving Panama, my mom said, "Our hearts kept breaking each time we walked out the door." They tried to give it time. They assumed conditions would improve, but the country was so ravaged that their hearts never stopped breaking. Eventually, they sold almost everything they owned and used the money to buy plane tickets to somewhere else, somewhere better, which to them had always meant the United States. A while after I was old enough to understand this story, I pointed out how backwards it was to have fled to the nation that had driven them out of theirs. But they never copped to the irony of it. They needed to believe they'd done the right thing and that it made sense. They were torn between wanting to look back and wanting to exist absolutely in the new life they'd created. At one point, they had planned to return. They'd thought that with enough time, Panama would be rebuilt and that their hearts, I guess, would heal. But while they waited for that day, they started making friends. My dad got a job as a busboy, and then later on as a dishwasher. Years passed. Enrique was in school, and I started too. My dad was promoted to line cook. More years slid by, and before they knew it, we had a life here. They had left their lives once before. They didn't want to do it again. So they applied for U.S. citizenship, sitting up at night reading the Constitution, a dictionary by their side, and studying for the exam. They contacted someone at the Panamanian consulate in Philadelphia who helped them navigate the paperwork. Then they woke up one morning, got dressed in their best clothes, caught a bus to the courthouse, and while my mom held me in her arms and my dad rested his hand on Enrique's shoulder, took an oath along with a group of other men and women who had made living in the United States a dream. We became Americans. We never went back to Panama, not even for a visit. It would have taken us forever to save enough money for plane tickets. Besides, my dad never wanted to take time off from his job. He probably could have asked for a few days of vacation time, but even after years of being there, making omelets and flipping pancakes, he knew, we all knew, that he was on the low end of the food chain. He could be replaced in a heartbeat. He didn't want to risk it. Because of that, we'd missed my Tia Gloria's wedding, which she'd had on a hillside in Boquete. She told my mom that her new husband, Esteban, had gotten so drunk that she'd convinced him to dance,
and that therefore the whole event was a success. We had my aunt on speakerphone, and my mom had said, "Take it from me, hermanita, they dance at the wedding and then they never do it again." My dad had said, "That's what you think?" and clutched my mom by the wrist, sending her into a small spin in the middle of the kitchen. She squealed with delight, while he swayed with her for a few beats, and then he broke out into some goofy merengue moves, kicking his leg up at the end and shouting, "Olé!" My aunt started yelling through the phone, "Are you still there? Celia? Rafael?" And my parents laughed until my mom dabbed the corners of her eyes with the back of her hand. I'd never seen them so happy with each other, even though it was just for those few seconds. We almost went back for my dad's high school reunion, which my dad somehow got into his head that he didn't want to miss. The reunion was on a Friday, so maybe, he told us, he could fix his work schedule so that he was off on Friday. We could fly there, go to the reunion, and then fly back Saturday night. He was usually off on Sundays, but if he took off Friday instead, he'd have to be back and work Sunday to make up for it. So one night would be the longest we could stay, but one night would be enough. He had decided. And it looked like we were going to try. My mom was as excited about the trip as I don't know what. She went to Sears to buy a new dress and had giddy phone conversations with my aunt about seeing each other again and what they would be able to pack into our 18 hours on the ground. She started laying out her clothes weeks in advance, even though my dad kept telling her she only needed two outfits, one to go and one to come home. "And why the hell do you have 10 pairs of shoes here?" he asked, pointing to the sandals and leather high heels my mom had lined up along the baseboard in the bedroom. 10? My mom scoffed. "I don't even own 10 pairs of shoes." My father counted them. "Fine, 7. That's still 6 too many." He told her that he intended to take only a duffel bag for our things, because that would make it easier to get through customs. My mom said, "I'll check my own bag then." My dad kicked the row of shoes my mom had lined up and sent them flying into the wall. He walked right up to my mom and held his index finger in front of her face. "One bag, Celia. One. For all 4 of us. Don't talk to me about it again." A few weeks before the reunion, my dad called the number on the invitation to RSVP. The guy who answered had been the class president. He and my dad joked around for a minute, and then my dad told the guy we were coming. According to what my dad told us later, the guy said, "We'll roll out the red carpet then." When my dad asked him what he meant by that, the guy said that my dad would have to forgive him if the party wasn't up to my dad's standards. "We didn't know the gringo royalty was coming. We'll have to get the place repainted before you arrive." When my dad asked again what the guy was talking about, the guy said he hoped my dad didn't expect them all to kiss his feet now and reminded my dad how humble Panama was. It didn't take long for my dad to slam the phone down. He stormed over to my mom, who was washing dishes, and said, "We're not going. If that's what they think, then we're not going." My mom said, "What?" "They think we're Americans now. And maybe we are. Maybe we don't belong there anymore after all." My dad went out on the balcony to smoke a cigarette, which he did whenever he was really upset. My mom stood in the kitchen, a soapy pot in her hand, and looked at me, baffled. "What just happened?" she asked. When I told her everything I'd been able to gather, she walked out to the balcony and closed the door behind her. At the commotion, Enrique came out of his room. "We're not going anymore," I told him.
"Huh?
On the trip?"
"Are you serious?" Enrique asked.
My brother and I huddled together, listening through the front door. I heard my mom say,
"Please, Rafa, he doesn't know anything about us. We can still go. You'll see, once we get there, all your friends, and everyone will love you."
I imagined her reaching out to touch his shoulder, the way she did sometimes when she was asking for something.
"Don't you miss it?" she asked. Can't you imagine landing there, being there again? You know how it smells? The air there, and seeing everyone again. Please, Rafa.
But my dad wasn't swayed. The following year, we talked about going back, too. My dad's anger over being cast as a holier-than-thou gringo had finally simmered down, and my mom, who couldn't bring herself to return the new dress she'd bought and who hadn't gotten over the disappointment of not being able to see her sister after all, had been dropping hints ever since that she would still like to go, even if the trip was only for one night again. She'd become a genius at turning any and every little thing into a way to talk about Panama. She would get a mosquito bite on her ankle and point out the welt to us, reminiscing about the bites she used to get in Panama, and wondering aloud, what the mosquitoes there looked like now? As if they were old friends. She would make rice and start talking about the gallo pinto at El Trapiche, which was her favorite restaurant, saying things like, I wonder how Cristobal, wasn't that the owner's name, is doing? Wouldn't it be nice to find out? We would drive over a bridge, and suddenly, she was talking about the Bridge of the Americas near the canal. Do you remember, Enrique? That time we took the ferry back from Taboga at night, and it was all lit up? It was so beautiful. Mayor, I wish you could have seen it. She sighed. Maybe one day. And my dad would sometimes shake his head at her melodrama, and other times would just stay quiet, like he'd fallen into the haze of a particular memory himself. My mom's birthday was September 22nd, so my dad finally gave in and made plans for us to go to Panama. The Toro family, one night only, put it in lights. My mom worked herself into a froth all over again, conferring with my tia Gloria on the phone. My aunt apparently said she wanted to take my mom to the new mall and for a drive through Costa del Este, which used to be a garbage dump, but now had been transformed into an up-and-coming area of the city and out for sushi on the causeway, and afterwards they could hit the clubs along Calle Uruguay, and yes, she realized they weren't 20 anymore, but it would be so much fun. Besides, she and my tío Esteban weren't doing so well, she told my mom. He was never home. He spent the night at friends' apartments, so she could use some distraction and someone to talk to. Not a divorce, my mom gasped. To her, there could be nothing worse. No, my aunt assured her, just problems. Then, less than 2 weeks before we were scheduled to go, two planes flew into the World Trade Center in New York City, and another one into the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. The country went into shock, and we went right along with it. My dad called my mom from the diner, where, on the television above the counter, he had just seen the second plane hit the second tower. They're blowing it up, he apparently told her. It's just like El Chorrillo. They're destroying it. And my mom, in her nightgown, rushed to the set and stood in front of it, watching with her hand over her mouth. I had been eating cereal in the kitchen. I carried my bowl over and stood next to her and kept eating, which, when I thought about it later, seemed kind of messed up, but at the time we didn't know what was happening. The world hadn't stopped, just stopped, like it would later that day and for days after. Everything was still just unfolding in front of our eyes, and we had no idea what to make of it. It didn't take long before everyone in our building was knocking on each other's doors and convening out on the balcony, standing around, stunned and shaking with fear. Nelia Safon just kept repeating, What is happening? What is happening? What the hell is happening? I heard my mom say to someone, We moved here because it was supposed to be safer. Where can we go after this? All day long, she kept herself no more than an arm's length from me and my brother, hugging us against her and then letting us go, like she wanted to assure herself that we were still there and that we were okay. Enrique, who was old enough by then that he usually squirmed away from my mom's embraces, must have known the situation was serious because he let her do it. I let her too, even though every time she did, Instead of comforting me, it only made me more scared. By evening, everyone's front doors were open, and people were roaming in and out of each other's units, watching each other's televisions as if a different set would deliver different news, checking to see if anyone had heard anything new, getting tedious translations. Benny Quinto led prayer circles in his living room and offered to smoke with anyone who needed to calm their nerves. "Weed," Enrique told me when he heard Benny talking about it. "Nice." Micho Alvarez paced up and down the balcony, talking on his cell phone and jotting things in his notebook. Gustavo Milojas, who was half Mexican and half Guatemalan, wrote a letter to the army telling them that as of that day, he was 100% American, and that he was ready to serve the country and kill the cowards who had murdered his fellow paisanos. At the end, he wrote, "And here is a list of people who are willing to join me." He drew a few blank lines and spent the afternoon trying to recruit everyone in the building. When my mom saw what it was, she said, "More killing? That's what you want? More?" And Gustavo said, "Not killing, justice." That year, around the holidays, we were all miserable. Holidays were always bad. My mom in particular got homesick, sometimes like it was a genuine illness. But that Christmas was the worst. We were depressed and on edge, still shaken up about September 11th, and then reshaken when someone tried to blow up another plane by hiding a bomb in his shoes 2 days before Christmas Eve. My aunt called, which cheered my mom up for a while, but once that wore off, she was more down than ever, shuffling around the house in her slippers, no makeup, her hair a disaster. She carried tissues in the pocket of her bathrobe and made a big show of dabbing her nose with them every so often. Eventually, my dad came up with an idea. "You want Panama?" he said. "A beach is the closest thing you're going to get." He hustled us out the door and down the street, where we took a chain of buses for an hour and a half to Cape Henlopen in southern Delaware. It was snowing when we arrived. Enrique kept complaining that the snow was going to mess up his beloved Adidas sneakers, and everything was so colorless and barren that it looked like the moon. I had to hand it to my dad, though. With the water and the sand, my mom said it almost was like a little piece of Panama. The waves roared in toward us, and then silently pulled back again, slipping over the shore. Even with the falling snow, the air had the sting of salt water, and we crunched broken seashells under our shoes. But one beach isn't every beach, and one home isn't every home. And I think we all sensed, standing there, just how far we were from where we had come, in ways both good and bad. "He's beautiful," my mom said, staring out at the ocean. She sighed and shook her head. "This country."
Gustavo Milojas. My name is Gustavo Milojas. I was born in Chinique, El Quiche, Guatemala in 1960, the year hell came to that country. I arrived in the United States on November 14, 2000. Before that, I resided in Mexico. My mother is of Guatemalan descent, while my father's bloodlines run through Mexico. However, my father was not part of my life. My mother raised my three brothers and me by herself in Guatemala. She did her best, working two jobs and attempting to teach us right from wrong, but there were forces beyond her control. The military in Guatemala at that time became too powerful, and the people revolted. The army began kidnapping citizens who they suspected were against them. They were burying people alive. They were raping women 30 times a day. They were laying babies on the ground and crushing their skulls with their boots. How could a baby be against them? Perhaps it was a way to torture the parents. I couldn't take it anymore. When I was 20, I decided to leave. I attempted to persuade my mother and my brothers to go to Mexico. I made the argument that because of my father, we had a claim to it. But my mother was stubborn. She said if I didn't like the way things were, I shouldn't run away. I should stay there and commit myself to fixing them. But that's what the guerrillas had been trying to do for decades, and I saw no progress. No, I told her. I need to go somewhere else. I went to Mexico on my own. I believed it would be easy for me to make a new home there, but no one in Mexico wanted anything to do with a Guatemalan. The Mexicans looked down on us. They believe Guatemalans are stupid. To tell them I was half Mexican only made things worse. They were offended to think that any Mexican man would have stooped so low as to be with a Guatemalan woman to create me. I was living in Córdoba. Things were terrible for me there. I couldn't find a job unless I was willing to let myself be taken advantage of, working sometimes for only a few pesos a day, until I met a woman named Isabel, who changed everything for me. She was Mexican, from Veracruz, and her parents disapproved of me. But we fell in love and decided we would be together no matter what anybody said. We married in 1982 and had two children. First a boy and then a girl. We were so happy. I was still treated poorly sometimes, but I had gained a different sort of confidence since being with Isabel, and the poor treatment didn't bother me as much. 17 years after we married, Isabel passed away. She had cancer of the breast. Here, I find that everyone knows about this cancer. Last fall, there were pink ribbons in the movie theaters and in all the stores, and someone told me it was for this type of cancer. But at that time, we lived in a small village called Tehuipango, where the medical care was very basic. We found a doctor who told us what she had, but he could not tell us how to fix it. He said, she needs to rest. She will die soon. I did my best to take care of her. By the time we found out, she was already very weak. I put bags of ice on her chest to help numb the pain. I gave her aspirin to ease the aches. Nothing helped. 3 months later, she was gone. The children were very upset. They were both in high school at that time. Isabel and I were so proud of them. They studied hard. They wanted to go to college. My son wants to become a businessman, and my daughter wants to become a nurse. After Isabel died, I didn't know how I would make this happen. Isabel was a cook. She made desserts for everyone in our village. Dulce de camote con piña, empanadas de guayaba, palanquetas de cacahuate. When someone wanted a birthday cake, they came to her. When someone was throwing a party, they came to her. Every day she sold fresh soup straight out of the pots on our stove. I worked too, harvesting maize and fava beans. But the money she made from cooking helped support us. Without it, we didn't have much. I came to the United States to earn more money for my children. They are living with a family friend now while I'm here. I did not think of it so much as a choice as an obligation. It is my obligation to provide a good life for them. My son is in college now, and my daughter will start college next year at Universidad Veracruzana in Orizaba. This makes me happy because I believe it means they will both get to do what they want to do. There are not many people who can say that. I thought it would be very difficult to cross. It was after September 11 and the security was supposed to be high. I crowded with a group of men into the back of a van with tinted windows. We were all on the floor, under a heavy black burlap blanket, and on top of that, a lot of empty cardboard boxes that were meant to look like freight. We drove right up to the checkpoint. A guard examined the driver's papers, which were legitimate. The guard did not know we were in the back of the van. He did not even look. The driver simply told him he was transporting construction supplies for a job in El Paso. There was a long pause. All of us in the back held our breath, waiting to be discovered. And then, the guard let the driver through. That was it. It was almost unbelievable to me. I found a job as soon as I could and began sending money back to my children. I started off in a mattress warehouse, dragging mattresses down metal ramps at the back of the store and loading them onto delivery trucks. When a mattress was defective, sometimes one of the employees kept it. The bed I have today is from that job. For a while, I worked at a canning factory where we packed chiles and salsa. It wasn't very clean. There were maggots everywhere. The owners blamed the conditions on the workers. Besides that, I didn't like standing in one place for 10 hours. We got only one break for 15 minutes. Now I have two jobs. 5 mornings a week, I work at the Newark Shopping Center movie theater, cleaning the bathrooms and the theaters. I make sure there's toilet paper in the stalls. I mop the floors. I have a wire brush I use to clean the sinks. In the evenings, I work at the Movies 10 movie theater in Stanton. That job is harder because there are so many theaters. If too many movies finish all at once, it's a challenge to clean the theaters before the next group of people comes in. I have been reprimanded for leaving an empty cup in the seat arm. Usually, I don't have time to go home between my shifts, so many times I eat popcorn and soda for dinner. But I am very grateful for these jobs. They allow me to send money to my children to pay for their schooling. When both of them graduate, I would like to go back to Mexico to be with them. My wish is that they'll do something worthwhile with their lives, something more important than sweeping popcorn. I have done what I can for them. I would like to see them give something back.
Alma. Arturo came home from work each day tired and hungry. The crevices of his skin caked with dirt. He went straight to the shower and stood under the spray of the warm water until I knocked on the door and told him that dinner was ready. When we started seeing each other, one of the traits that had attracted me to Arturo was how serious he could be. The way that he furrowed his eyebrows when I used to watch him on a job. The intensity of focus and the pride he took in doing the job well. I was stubborn, but I had never been as solemn as him, and I admired the strength that his solemnity seemed to represent. Of course, in time, I learned his soft spots, like bruises on a piece of fruit. He was compassionate and kind, and hearing of others' hardships affected him so much that usually he couldn't stop himself from doing something to help. Once, when a young girl in our town lost her sight after a propane tank exploded in her face, Arturo built a birdhouse and put it on a stake in the girl's backyard so that when she opened her bedroom window, she would hear the songs of warblers and mockingbirds. But he could also be uncompromising and hard on himself. And since the accident, those traits that I loved had given way to something darker. Seriousness had become gravity. Sensitivity had transformed into melancholy. I didn't always see it. Arturo fought to preserve his better nature, but occasionally his despair came through. I found him one Sunday morning in the kitchen on his hands and knees, his head inside a cabinet. I had just gotten dressed, and I went up behind him and kicked him lightly. "Hey," he shouted, curling his head out. "What are you doing?" I asked. "I'm looking for a bowl." "Why?" "Maribel wanted pineapple." "I would have gotten it for her." "I thought we had a glass bowl," he said. "We didn't bring it with us." "Why not?" "We have a metal bowl." I started toward the cabinet where I'd stored it. "I don't want a metal bowl," he said. "It's a perfectly good bowl. When I eat something out of a metal bowl, it tastes different afterwards." "What are you talking about?" "It tastes like I mixed in a handful of coins." I smiled. "You know what I'm saying, don't you?" "Yes, I know what you're saying." "I wish we had brought that glass bowl," he said. I looked at him and understood that we weren't just talking about bowls anymore. I smoothed my hand over his thick hair, cupping the back of his neck. Arturo wrapped his arms around my legs like a child. "We'll see it again," I said. And I imagined it. That glass bowl with the flat bottom and the broad rim, nestled in the lower kitchen cabinet whose door creaked when it opened, nestled among the pots and pans in the room, nestled among other rooms. The bathroom where Maribel had hung a calendar to mark when to expect her next period. The bedroom where the nightgowns and socks and collared shirts that we had left behind were piled on top of the quilt my mother had sewn and given to us as a wedding gift. The sala, with the bone-inlaid picture frames, housing black and white photographs of our grandparents, who had passed, and of our great-grandparents, whom we had never known, all of which were nestled between the backyard, with our old rope hammock, and the stone half-wall that was crumbling at one corner, and the front yard, which was hardly a yard at all. Just pebbles and aloe plants and a space where Arturo parked the pickup truck that he and I used to sit in together while we looked up at the stars. And all of that nestled in the town where the three of us had been born and had grown up. The town where my parents still lived and where Arturo's parents had died. The town where we'd shared meals and drinks and late nights filled with laughter with our lifelong friends, all of it waiting so patiently, all of it so far away. For a while, I made the meals we used to eat in Pascuaro. Sopa tarasca and huachinango and corundas con churipo. But eating foods from home in a place that wasn't our home only made things worse. Besides, the imported chiles and guajillo were expensive, and already we were living on so little. We had some money saved, but Arturo and I had both agreed not to touch it unless there was an emergency, which meant unless we had to take Maribel to a doctor or rush her to the hospital. For now, we were getting by on Arturo's paycheck week to week, which was just enough to cover rent and bus fare and food. Eventually, I stopped shopping at Gigante because it drove me crazy to see all the things we couldn't afford to buy. All those crates of nopalitos and epazote and tender corn, all the shelves of pickled red onions, and tequesquite and coriander taunting me. I started buying food at the Dollar Tree instead. Food in cans, food in boxes. Add water and heat. One morning, I saw a Mexican woman there taking three drum-like containers off a shelf. "What is that?" I asked her, pointing. "Avena," she said. "Oatmeal." "Like atole?" My mother used to make me atole de grano when I was a girl. The dense corn kernels buried in the anisillo broth. But I hadn't eaten it in a long time. The idea that this might be something similar piqued my interest. "This is the American version," the woman said. "It's not the same, but it's cheap. One can will feed you for a week, and it's hot, good for the winter." "Thank you," I told her, and started loading containers of oatmeal into my basket until I cleared the shelf of it. I made it that afternoon. The instructions on the back were in English, but there were drawings too. A faucet pouring water into a measuring cup, a hand holding a spoon and stirring, and there were numbers that I could read. I followed it all, heated it on the stove, and before I knew it, I had made a pot of pale gray mush. I dipped a finger in. It tasted like paper. Maybe the slightest hint of nuttiness somewhere at the edges. The woman had been right. It wasn't good. Not at all like the atole I remembered. But I had barely made a dent in the oats, and I had cooked a whole pot of them. It was enough to feed all three of us. Maybe I thought I could sprinkle some cocoa powder on it, or stir in some honey just to liven the flavor. Maribel and Arturo looked skeptical when I set out the bowls that night. "What is it?" Maribel asked, poking at it with her spoon. I had made it too early. I didn't know that the longer it sat, the more it hardened. By the time I put it out for dinner that night, it was like rubber. "Oatmeal," I said, pronouncing the word in English. "The Americans love it." I pointed to one of the cardboard cans on the counter. "You see that man? He makes it on his farm." Maribel touched the surface with her finger. "It feels weird." "You're not supposed to use your fingers to eat it. Use your spoon and put some in your mouth. Come on. Which one of you is going to try it first? Arturo?" But I could tell Arturo had his own reservations. He just stared at the bowl with his spoon poised in his hand. "Maribel," I asked. "What's it called again?" Arturo said. "Oatmeal." Arturo tried to stifle a laugh in his nose that escaped anyway. The sound of it, the tinkle of joy in the midst of our bleak American winter, was startling. "What are you laughing at?" I asked. "Say it again," Arturo said. "What? Oatmeal?" His face cracked into a smile beneath his mustache. I loved seeing that smile. So rare these days. I would have said the word for the next 100 years if it made him smile like that. "Oatmeal," I repeated. Arturo started laughing. "Oatmeal," he said, and I laughed too. In English, it sounded funny to us, as mushy and formless as the cereal itself. And then the sound of angels. Maribel laughed too, light and crystalline, thin glass bubbles of laughter. Arturo looked at me in astonishment. She was laughing, laughing. She had smiled once in Pátzcuaro when the three of us were eating ice cream in the square, and Arturo's had fallen and splattered on the sidewalk. And she had cried at no longer being able to do simple things like hold a fork, or write her name, or wash her own hair. Although, of course, in time, she had relearned all of that. But laughter? It was the first time in over a year that we had heard it. Just like her old laugh. Just like our old Maribel. "Oatmeal," I bellowed. "Oatmeal," Arturo said with tears in his eyes. He jammed his spoon into the bowl and dug out a mouthful. "Delicious," he declared, rubbing his belly after he had swallowed, making a show of it, and the three of us broke out in helpless, gorgeous laughter once again. I lay in bed most nights, long after Arturo and Maribel had fallen asleep, and stared at the ceiling. Sleep was like wealth. Elusive and for other people. I lay rigid on the mattress, remembering what it used to be like before all of this. Maribel running at the hammock, flipping it over her head, laughing wildly. Maribel darting across the street ahead of us, looking back and tapping her toes in mock impatience. Maribel swimming in the lake with her friends, coming home with her hair dripping wet. Her clothes clinging to her thin frame. Arturo and I looked at her sometimes in awe. It had been difficult for us to conceive a child. We had tried for nearly 3 years, visiting doctors and curanderas. My mother had said prayers and begged for an audience with the priest. Every month we waited to see if perhaps it had happened at last. Every month suffering the disappointment that it hadn't. And then, after we had said, Enough with the doctors and with the discussion, just as we started to believe that having a child simply wasn't going to be part of our lives, that being parents was a distinction we weren't meant to have. When we had hardened ourselves to the pain of seeing everyone around us caring and feeding their babies, those downy heads and wet lips, I missed my period. We had a hiccup of hope. Could it be, we thought? 9 months later, we were holding her in our arms. Tiny starfish hands, ribs pushing up against her skin like piano keys. She wriggled and croaked. Our Maribel. You won't ever have another one, the doctor told us. But that didn't matter. We had her. Maribel was 14 when the accident happened. Arturo was leading the construction of an outbuilding for a rancher who had bought more livestock than he had room to house, and Maribel had circled around me that morning like a gnat, begging me to let her go to the job site with her father. Ever since she was young, she had clung to Arturo, interested in everything he did, every move he made.